Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Homelessness, drug addiction and a chaotic lifestyle means for some, healthcare comes at the bottom of the list of priorities. But over the next 2 days, a street medicine symposium in Limerick will examine how to reach the most vulnerable. Dr. Patrick O'Donnell is a GP with social inclusion in the Midwest and Maeve O'Doherty is a child development homelessness project coordinator with ABC Startright. And both Patrick and Maeve are involved in the street medicine symposium and are on the line now. Good morning to you both. Patrick, I'm going to start with you because I know at your surgery you're working with marginalised patients and many of them are dealing with issues like addiction to crack cocaine. What challenges does that bring for you?
Yeah, hi Tara, good morning and thanks for having us on from UL here today. Yet we're running a what's called a low threshold inclusion health GP clinic. So that means that the barriers to access to get to the services that we run are as low as possible in terms of registration, but also in terms of the supports that are available to the patients who come in the door. Drug use, I suppose, is a fact of life, and we're seeing kind of evolving changes in the way that drugs are being used. And crack cocaine, like you've mentioned, is one of those things that we've had to learn about over the last couple of years. We've learned, and part of the purpose of this conference is to learn from each other, from projects around the country, learn from people, experts by experience. So we have included people who, I suppose, bring the voice of people who have actually used crack cocaine and used drugs. We're using research that has been conducted recently by the Midwest Drug and Alcohol Task Force and analytically into crack cocaine use and the effects of it and the health effects of it in particular for the patients that we're seeing.
Okay. Can you explain to people listening, because many people won't be aware, crack cocaine, how is that used and what are the particular problems that it's posing for you in dealing with people who have that addiction?
Of course, people are probably more familiar with cocaine that's inhaled. Crack cocaine is mainly used through crack pipes. So people will cook the crack and it will be inhaled using either crack pipes that are distributed by the HSE or crack pipes that are homemade. So people will use plastic bottles or inhaler, the covers of inhalers or other plastic kind of receptacles to do that. So as you can imagine, if you're using plastic bottles and other things, there's damage from chemicals that you're inhaling as well as the drug. The other way we see crack cocaine being used is being injected. And over the last number of months, I suppose the pattern in terms of injecting, mixing heroin and crack together, so it'll often be called a snowball or a speedball. So people are actually mixing heroin and crack in the one syringe and using that. And that obviously has a very unpredictable effect. If you think of it, heroin is a depressant and cocaine itself is a stimulant. So we're often unsure the overall effect that that's going to have on the person. But also when you bring crack cocaine into the mix, people need to use it more and more often. So you'll have the damaging effects of injecting drug use are multiplied. So you'll have to inject more often during the day. So if you may have injected 2 or 3 times a day, when you bring crack cocaine in, you may inject 6, 7, 8 times a day. So you have the increased risk of clots, of infections, of bloodborne viruses. So we're I suppose, learning and dealing with the effects of this over the last number of months.
So that's hugely problematic. I mean, if you're taking a drug as often as you need to take crack cocaine once you're in the throes of addiction, that's going to lead to massive health problems.
Yeah, and it's something that I suppose has evolved over time, and us as service providers have to be really, I suppose, front and centre in learning about these new trends. And it's something the National Social Inclusion Office, in particular in the addiction side, are very keen to do. So they learn about these new trends. And as a community and people providing these health services across the country, like this particular street medicine symposium at the minute, one of the big purposes of is sharing knowledge about things that are evolving, about changes that are evolving and how best to support our patients. Because at the end of the day, the patient is at the centre of it. They're coming to us saying, I am using this substance, I need your help, I need to try and do it more safely. And that's the basic premise of harm reduction, while also dealing with the knock-on health issues with it. The piece of research that was conducted by Anna Leffy and the Midwest Regional Drugs Task Force was specifically looking at the health and mental health needs of people actively using crack cocaine. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, there's been major investment in terms of a research project, a program with the HSE and with the Gardaí locally and with Anna Liffey locally, specifically looking at supporting our patients who are in that situation.
Okay, I want to bring Maeve in at this point. Maeve, we know homeless figures for last March show us nearly 3,500 children are homeless in the state. Now, you work with children who are aged between 0 and 6 who are homeless in Limerick. How many children is your project aware of?
My project is aware of 112 children, and those figures now are from April, the last time I collated those figures. 112 children between the ages of 0 and 6 currently living in temporary accommodation in Limerick City. So those are families that would have been allocated a placement by the Homeless Action Team.
So they're in places like hotels and homeless hubs?
Yeah, hotels and homeless hubs.
Now, you're working with the children, but you're also working with their parents to try and combat the effects of homelessness. What does that mean, Maeve, for what you do?
Okay, so basically we know that homelessness is an adverse experience in childhood, and we also know that adversity in childhood results in poorer health outcomes for citizens. So my job, I suppose, and we also know that children are presenting with developmental needs, higher developmental needs. So my job, I suppose, aims to buffer the effects of that.
So when there are developmental needs or developmental challenges, just describe to us what you're seeing.
I'm seeing, you know, delayed growth, motor skills, fine motor skills, sometimes delayed speech and language skills, sometimes what parents would describe as behavioural issues with children, with their children, or, you know, children that maybe aren't supported to regulate their emotions as of yet. I'm seeing difficulties with food nutrition as well. Like, as you can imagine, you know, like if you were placed in a hotel, for example, and you had a child or a baby that you were trying to wean onto solid food, that parent does not have a place to store that food or to cook that food. So the nutrition is limited because of those physical situations.
And how do you address that?
So what I have done, and what our project has done for the weaning situation specifically, we came together with the dietetics department in UL, and we've designed a more weaning information, weaning resources that are more sensitive, I suppose, to the needs of parents. So I would be trained to kind of deliver weaning information to the general public. But what I noticed on the ground with parents is that the information that I was disseminating with the parents was quite insensitive. You know, it was all about home-cooked meals, yeah. What we did we came together, we designed a resource and really about, like, the nutritional value of long-life food or food that doesn't need refrigeration or cooking, so that they can actually have a pathway to providing nutrition for their children in some way. So yeah, we're kind of just meeting them where they're at and trying to kind of bridge that gap in whatever way that we can.
And Maeve, I'm sure you're dealing with parents who are very stressed. They're very anxious, and it can be difficult for them then to try and focus or have time to plan for the developmental needs of their young children.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was reflecting on this yesterday, because I was reflecting on my own experience of, you know, having to come on here this morning and having to do a presentation. And yesterday I was in that fight or flight phase, and, you know, my heartbeat was beating out my chest and I was sweaty and I had a headache. And at some stages yesterday, I couldn't even think clearly. And I thought to myself, I'm really privileged to have that very short experience of this fight or flight, functional fight or flight experience. And for some parents that are living in homelessness and children, that experience is quite prolonged. So imagine being, you know, I couldn't string two sentences together at a certain stage yesterday. So imagine having to think of all these things that must be done in order to provide that, those, or to buffer those developmental milestones for their children.
So what you're trying to do, Maeve, is just to create some calm, to create some space so that all of that noise around fight or flight is quietened.
Exactly. I suppose so my job really is to build relationships with the parents first and foremost, to try and support the parent to slow down, watch the child, listen to what the child's doing, but also really point out the strengths that parents have, because often we're so busy about thinking what we have to do, generally as parents, that we don't kind of, we're not very mindful of the interactions we're already having with our children that are contributing to better outcomes.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's about slowing down and showing parents that they're already doing this. That's kind of the strengths-based element. And from that, then, the relationship grows and we can support them in a better place.
Well, you describe it and explain it very well. Patrick, you spoke earlier about people and their addiction issues, the people that you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Do you find that they're trying to hide that because of the stigma in their community when it comes to accessing help, that the stigma might be the thing that prevents them from doing that?
Yeah, like it's one of the fundamental things that we encounter pretty much every day in the clinics that we run. Stigma from wider society, stigma from people working in services, health services, education services. And also there's a lot of self-stigma. So if you're hearing negative or stigmatizing things, a lot of people are supposed to pick up and internalize those. So a lot of what we do in the Low Threshold Inclusion Clinic here in the Midwest is trying to support people, like Meg was saying, in terms of stabilizing things, in terms of humanizing things, in terms of really supporting people. So we work very closely with key workers who sit down and support patients with some of the basic needs in terms of linking in with accommodation, help with forms, help with literacy, help with appointments, help with prescriptions, as well as the health piece. Because the health piece fails if those fundamentals are not in place. The health piece doesn't succeed unless those basic kind of social determinants are met. So over time, and this inclusion health approach that we're talking about at this conference is about wrapping as much as possible around people. Remember, Claire, quite often people don't have one kind of stigmatizing factor. So a lot of the patients that we're working with may have maybe engaged in sex work, maybe homeless, may have addiction issues, but, you know, all wrapped into one person. And the resilience in the patients that we see, you know, to make it kind of through the door and to come and see us. And they're coming looking for support and looking for help. And with the addiction side, people are looking, they're saying, look, I'm using this substance. I need to use this substance. It's got a hold on me. But can you at least support me to do it a little bit more safely? And can you support me then beyond that?
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at, you know, treatment options, looking at referring people to the methadone program, looking at providing naloxone, which is a reversal agent for opioids, doing testing for bloodborne viruses. So we wrap as much as possible around the patient at the centre.
And Patrick, I was talking to Maeve there about people who are living in really difficult situations in hubs or in hotels. But if you have addiction issues, health complications, and you're sleeping rough, that's on a whole other scale, isn't it?
Yeah. So some of my patients who I've seen this week are staying in tents dealing with addiction issues. And yes, you're trying to manage what is a really difficult kind of physical withdrawal or physical situation while staying in tents. So your risk of infections, chest infections, asthma exacerbations, all of the you know, the normal kind of run-of-the-mill diseases or conditions that people can have. And then if you're trying to build somebody back up in terms of their health, or you're trying to treat their hepatitis C or support them with alcohol withdrawal, they really need a roof over their heads. So we encourage, and we work quite closely with the Homeless Action Team and the council here in terms of accommodation availability. We know the wide pressures across the system, but we have a sort of channels that we can approach in terms of the health needs of people. And you'll see it when people are being discharged from hospitals, the pathways here, particularly in the Midwest, in terms of supporting people that they would be in accommodation. Because as you can imagine, coming out of hospital after surgery or after any kind of hospitalization for a prolonged period, you need time to rest and recuperate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's difficult enough to go home to a house with heating and all of the services available to you, but to go anywhere else is just even more difficult. So our job is, I suppose we're like the canary in the mine for the health service. A lot of our time, we feed back internally in the health service. We advocate internally in the health service for the patients that we're talking about. We're also a link, and we link people in with key workers and with other supports, because there's huge challenges. And at the end of the day, people, you know, people deserve, want services, want to improve their health. We found that during COVID as well, you know, in terms of the vaccination piece, we took what was being done for the wider population, the vaccinations and the swabbing piece. We modified it a little bit. We brought it closer to people. We made it kind of walk in, and we had, you know, more numbers than we could have predicted. So people were really keen, you know, to stick with the plan, to preserve
yes.
their health.
And once you put the service in place and make it accessible, you're finding
exactly.
that people will use it. Patrick, thank you very
exactly.
much for joining us, Dr. Patrick O'Donnell, and also Maeve O'Doherty. And Maeve is from ABC Startright, and that Street Medicine Symposium is happening today and tomorrow in Limerick. We'll be back after this break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.